Let's start with prayer. Father, we know we need your Spirit to work in our hearts and minds and our imaginations if worthwhile outcomes are to be achieved. So we ask that Spirit in Christ's name. Amen. Modern genetics are increasingly difficult to keep up with. I have lived through what I call three stages of genetics. When I was 13, the human genome was, as Crick thought and Watson, done. Of course, it wasn't. That was just simply their hubris. They didn't know what it was. It was a physicist who shared the Nobel Prize with them who actually said, this has got to be a code. And it didn't go too fast at that stage. But it undermined something that some of you might remember when the idea at medical school was one gene defect, one disease, a very one-to-one relatedness. But it wasn't that long before it started to become more complex. So take cystic fibrosis as an example. It is fundamentally one mutation which changes a small zinc gate on the chloride channel. But there are now about, I don't do cystic fibrosis and haven't done for 20 years, but even when I last looked, there were more than 20 different subtypes. And the genetic information that led to those subtypes does give us prognostic information, for instance. When I started in medical school, cystic fibrosis was called mucoviscidosis, and you didn't expect the children to live to be two. But that was only because we were diagnosing only the worst ones. And then, as time went by, we now have a disease where there's one subset, they don't find out they've got cystic fibrosis till they've got their old age pension, if there isn't a smart physician who picks it up earlier. And it doesn't do them much good if it does. So that was the next stage in genetics. When I started as an academic in the biochemistry department, there was lots of talk of junk DNA. Those that knew, in inverted commas, said, well, most of DNA is just a load of junk. It doesn't do anything. At least I wasn't that arrogant. I don't claim to be in any way free of arrogance. But now, of course, it's a few percent that is called junk. The rest matters, not in the straight gene way, but in all sorts of sophisticated ways. The next thing that came along, well, not necessarily chronologically, is the realization that the gene itself is capable of multiple modifications. So the whole story moved from DNA to what happens to DNA later on in the program, where it gets modified in various ways, because when you change, for instance, the pH, or put a different sugar in the system, you give the shape a twist, and you get a different phenomenon. So gene products are modified all the way along the way. So we've now got, I think, certainly in the thousands of proteins from what we would have thought of as a single gene in 1953. That makes the complexity of the whole thing almost beyond imagining. God's fascination by shape is amazing. Everything appears to be shape in some way or another. But that's where we've got to now. Now, what's going to happen next? Well, quite quickly, of course, we started realizing that the genetic diseases, we could actually do eugenics again. We didn't call it that. But the first thing that happens when a gene is identified is that within weeks, it's technically possible to have a very good test to diagnose it in utero. In most cases, there's no treatment. The only function is to tell mother that she's going to have a baby with CF. But that isn't what the geneticists want to do. The easiest way to cement this thought into your mind is just to remember an overheard conversation from many years ago in the cystic fibrosis clinic in the Children's Hospital in Ottawa. And a little runt said to an older CF kid, they all know one another, Mom went to hospital And she wouldn't tell me why. She wasn't there very long. And the older guy said, oh, she's going to have another baby like you. She got rid of it. Just think of the psychological ramifications of that. And that's just the beginning. I mean, these kids have enough to carry, and now you tell them, oh, but by and large, we don't want you. That's where we're at. And of course, what's in sight now is straightforward eugenics. The intention, certainly in Canada, and I'm sure in the US, I haven't seen the actual committee, I don't know whether they've brought it out into the open, but in Canada they're quite straightforward about it. They're planning to get rid of approximately 30 genetic disorders before birth. Now, the average children's hospital currently needs a population base of over 1 million to keep its skills up to top level. That, even that in Canada, with less than 40 million people in the second largest country in the world, means a lot of people are a long way from top flight expertise in pediatrics. But when this is all over, we'll only need about 6 hospitals for the whole country. I don't know how this is going to work out, but certainly skills for children as a whole will be diminished when children that God sent into the world with a problem from our point of view are no longer with us. And of course, when we say their lives are not worth living, they don't agree with you. When you talk to them about it, they say, of course, I'd love not to have had cystic fibrosis, but I don't want to die. They're very clear about that. And in some areas, it's quite amusing in a way. Muscular dystrophy, they used to give up around 10 or 11. You know, they were running out of muscles they could move. They didn't want to go on a respirator. Now they do. Some of them, at least, because other things have advanced. My favorite example of this is I was in the University of Philadelphia a few years ago now, and one of the guys, a Christian guy, has been working on muscular dystrophies, and he's renowned for the superb PowerPoints that he has. They're all made by the kids. They keep on top of his work and everybody else's, because they're superb with computers. The engineers have got it to the point where as long as you can move your eyelashes, so to speak, you can use a computer. So he said he'd got one little guy at that point who has great pleasure in his... He's got a company. Believe it or not, it's a debt recovery agency. Because he's absolutely superb at tracking people down. So when he gets to them, he loves to call them up with his artificial voice and say, we know where you are. If you don't pay, I'm going to come and break every bone in your body. He has fun. But all this sort of stuff is going to be precluded if what we're talking about today goes through in the way that unthinking public, well, they are, sadly, I can't even give them that excuse. People whose primary concern is the budget, with no moral column in the budget and no recognition of what the role of these children is in our world. The medievals knew. They said that particularly the mentally disabled were closer to God than the rest of us because they don't carry a grudge into tomorrow. Isn't that beautiful? We have a Down syndrome children, a child in camp at the moment, Laurel. She's classic, you know. They're always friendly. They're always happy. And not all the syndromes are. I ran a clinic. The last clinic I ran was for severely metabolically disabled children. It included Laurel CP as well. I became interested in that area, ethically, which was interesting. That's the way it happened. In the Caribbean, where I was studying severe malnutrition, I was not a deeply involved Christian. And what we did in that research unit was study severely malnourished children. Now, we didn't do anything that was dangerous to them, but we were guilty of using them, of instrumentalizing them in some sense. The children came to the TMIU by referral from the ghettos, because one mother would say to another, "Where can I take my child?" And they say, "Well, don't go to the children's hospital. You have to go to a little place on the university. They're the only place who can save that child." So they knew in the ghetto. So mom would bring the baby, and she'd say, "Can you save my baby?" And by this stage that I'm talking about, the answer was, "Well, we'll try hard, and we've got a good chance. Now, we do like you, if you will, to give us permission to do some extra tests on your child, so that we can learn more about how to treat this condition. Your child is benefiting from previous mums who said yes to that." They all said yes. They put their thumb on the sheet, and that was it. Away they went. Now, what I was doing required taking, relatively speaking, quite large samples of blood from a 10-pound two-year-old. And the only way to do that, because I needed the white cells to be in good condition, was by doing a direct jugular vein puncture. Now, mums would not have been happy watching me do that. They didn't, of course. But I knew I was good at it, and I knew that I wasn't going to damage anyone. But Paul Ramsey, I think America's greatest medical ethicist before the bioethicist took over, convinced me later that was questionable. Whenever you instrumentalize a patient, that's questionable. Ends don't justify means in a Christian world. It's a difficult discussion. It's not a straightforward one. But when I got to Ottawa, I said, "Well, I'm going to try to do that anyway." And the first group I found was the CF children. That was okay, because they volunteered for what I wanted to do. An amazing experience, and it turned my life around. It was one of many things that had to happen in the 80s to get... I wouldn't be here today, but for children with CF. We'd been fortunate in the Caribbean to end up writing the permanent protocols for the treatment of severe malnutrition forever. Astonishingly, we still get emails frequently about it. Because when we left Jamaica in 1979, the last 100 babies to go through the unit before I left, we saved every single one. And they were 10 pounds, two-year-olds or worse. And I'd learnt a lot in 7 years. The most beautiful experience relating to that is that these mothers, of course, were poor. So we'd say it's going to take us 5 weeks, perhaps more, 5 to 9 weeks to get your baby back to absolute normal, depending on various factors. And they couldn't afford even the bus fare to come with any degree of regularity. So it was not rare for it to be a few weeks before they came to see how the child was. Now, the unit was quite impressive, architecturally, so to speak, built by the Wellcome Trust and British Medical Research Council. So they almost invariably went round the back. One end was laboratories, the other end was a ward. And they'd come in from the veranda into the ward and burst into tears. And if you were there, you had the pleasure, "Don't cry," because you knew no one had died. The baby would recognize them before they recognized the baby, because we were doubling their weight in 40 days. The only thing they disliked was the fact they were a lot blacker than they were before, because malnourished children don't bother to make melanin. But that was a beautiful experience. Arriving in Canada, I went round the hospital looking for malnutrition in the modern hospital, and it's there when you have educated eyes. And 30 years ago, more than 30 years, nearly 40 years ago now, I'm getting older than I think, most children dying of cystic fibrosis were technically malnourished. They're not like World Vision pictures. World Vision takes 2% of the burden of malnutrition, and because it really looks pathetic, they use that to raise money. But it is only 2%. It's not an honest way of presenting the problem. But that the skin changes and the swelling doesn't happen in CF. It's just they don't have enough muscle mass to go with their length. They're pathologically thin, if you like, anorexia nervosa without the intent. So I wanted two questions. Is it reversible? Is it worth reversing? So you had to do an experimental study to answer that question, jump through the hoops to get permission. The first volunteer was a 15-year-old boy with the body mass of an 11-year-old boy. He volunteered immediately as soon as I sent a note round saying I was interested in doing these studies. And the next time he was in town, he came and found me immediately and said, I want to be on that study. I said, I haven't even told you what I want to do yet, Stephen. And he said, I don't care what it is, I'll do it. And he did. And what I needed to do, of course, was to feed him through a nasogastric tube for a month. And given the cough they have in CF, I had to say, look, Stephen, that tube's probably going to be replaced at least 100 times during the month if we're going to get this protocol finished. Can you handle that? He said yes. And he never complained. We very quickly became friends. We both had the same ironic sense of humour, which helps if you've got CF. Monty Python was really funny. And anyway, about halfway through the month, on a Sunday, the nurses called, just after I got back from church, and said Stephen had coughed up his tube again. They'd got so many admissions, they were not going to replace the tube till 7 o'clock at night. So if I wanted my protocol followed, I'd have to go and put the tube in myself. So, fine. I only lived 7 minutes from the hospital, no big deal. So I went out, got to his bed, and he noticed I was wearing a suit. It was Sunday, and it was a long while ago. We were still sort of dressing up for God was still fashionable. And he said, oh, you've been to church? I said, yes, do you go to church? He said, yes. I asked him where he went. He was Catholic, I was Protestant. And I was so well trained in this very liberal part of North America, nobody ever talked about faith. And I didn't either. I put the tube in and went home. But his amazing mother, who was going to lose 3 children to CF, she didn't have a normal one, the next week stopped me in the corridor and said, you had an opportunity on Sunday to talk to Stephen about faith and you didn't take it. You would do that very well. She had no evidence for that. If I believed in words of prophecy, which I think I do, that was probably one of them. I didn't take any notice for quite a while. She was to take a role in it once more yet. So for Stephen it didn't work. He got about 400 grams, not 6 kilos. But there was enough evidence that these were teething troubles. We could solve this problem. It was going to work. And it did. We put the first permanent feeding tube into a CF child in Ottawa nearly 40 years ago now. If you go to a CF clinic these days, even adult ones, you'll find these little buttons. It wasn't a button to begin with. In fact, a button's not the best thing for CF, but it's the easiest thing. But it's worldwide, you know, where CF is worldwide. So that's been an amazing experience. But 4 years later, I didn't do day-to-day care, but I was called to go and see him. And when I got there to his bed, he was clearly dying. His mum was sitting there and been sitting there. He hadn't said anything for an hour or so. Fairly typical behaviour. You don't want to be alone. You've got CO2 levels going up if you're lucky and you just have a mild headache. They don't usually want to bother with an aspirin even. And then they fade away in a terminal coma. We manage their death very well. We don't confront the meaning of death very well. And that's what was about to happen to me. When I came in, he said, sit down, I want to talk to you. Well past the normal doctor-patient relationship, I sat down and said, Stephen, I'm sorry you're so sick. Can I do anything for you? And he said, it says in the Bible, if you ask anything in my name, I'll give it to you. I'm 19 and I'm dying and I don't want to. What do you say? What would you want to do? I wanted to get out of that room as fast as possible, but that was not an option. He was a friend. I tried the professorial escape route. Stephen, that's a difficult question. It will take a little while. And I got a lovely Monty Python answer, a wisp of a smile, and I have a little while. So I worked my way through the creeds. We had that in common. And of course, that didn't help because he believed them all. The problem was, it wasn't helping. And I didn't know what to say. So I was praying too. It is possible to do two things at once. Lord, you know I need help. Help. And as usual, he did. Into my head, he inserted a couple of sentences from Annie Dillard. Any Annie Dillard readers here? Yeah. It's a great discovery, isn't it? She's lived a disordered life, so she knows what reality is. I love her thing about going to church. It's a few years out of date now, where they hand you a grubby little book. They should be handing out crash helmets. If God Almighty turns up, we're in trouble. but that wasn't the sentence came to mind. It was this one. Oh yes, God will provide for all your needs. But do read the small print. He decides what your needs are, not you. And I knew what to say. By this time, children were running on the ward who wouldn't have had enough energy to walk. Little boys were still managing to skate for a minute or two who would have been watching. It was working. And it was certainly going to give them at least 5 years of extra life. And their dying process, which previously, the last year of life, if your death is by malnutrition, is also a year of depression that doesn't respond to antidepressants. Because what it needs is the energy to run the neurons. Antidepressants don't work, food does, if you can get it in. Any seriously malnourished child, you can put a needle in, it will never cry. It won't waste the energy. When it starts to cry, you know it's getting better. I'd already pointed out to him that what he had done had made a difference to the world. And I said, Stephen, I think that what God is saying to you is something like this. Stephen, you have done all that I want you to do. You have coughed enough. It's time to come home. Both you and I know that you're going to die in the next few hours unless there's a miracle. Can you believe that because this is God's choosing at the time, that it will be good for you? And there's a profound silence, and he looked up and smiled. He said, thank you. That helps a lot. I think I can. And he died very peacefully a few hours later. But his lovely mother had not finished with me. About 2 weeks later, I got a note. And I lost it for years, and it dropped out of a book in the last year. I'd remembered what she said, but I had turned it into somewhat more elegant prose than she had used. But I'll stick to my version because she deserves the praise. She certainly said this, but she didn't say it quite so crisply. She said, it was ironic that you were not allowed to give food to Stephen for his body, but thank God you were there when he needed food for his soul. He had been asking this question of his priest, his family, his doctor. Everyone had pushed it away, saying, no, you're not dying, Stephen. You don't need to worry about that. He knew he was. Now, if I hadn't turned up, nobody would have said anything. Of course, God was going to put what I said as a banished memory in a few hours' time. It wasn't for Stephen, primarily. It was certainly for his mother. It was very important to her that he die well. That she realized that this can happen and be all right. She told me years later that if God had told her what he wanted her to do, she would have said it's impossible, but it wasn't. That's her witness. But for me, of course, it was a guilt trip because, and some of you are probably in the same state, but being Americans, not like me, I hadn't had a conversation like that with a patient for 20 years. That's terrible. And I realize in our very liberal school, social workers in particular would have been appalled that I should talk like that. Many of them. Not the best ones. But it's not their fault that they're got at by a dominant secular view of the world. And I knew that if someone of my seniority didn't say this is a good thing to do and talk about it, The students would never have the courage to do it. So that was a turning point in my life. So I owe a lot to these children. The second group to come along were children with cerebral palsy and variants of it. This time, it required the breaking of your rules. If I'd been in America, what I did, what happened, would have been illegal, according to Hillary, the HIPAA rules. I've never heard of a more stupid law for a hospital than that one. That privacy, as defined by some wretched liberal who's never been in the situation of being ill in that way, should dominate, is unbelievable. I couldn't even make a list of the number of problems that have been solved in an elevator, in the cafeteria, even in the middle of the corridor. Even once shouting across a crowd, "John, we've got a patient you'll be interested in with a serum sodium of 70. We're just about to put some saline in. Do you want to see her?" I said, "Yes, don't give her any saline. I'll get some blood first." It turned out that she was actually hypernatremic. Because, of course, we think sodium, we give the sodium or whatever it is as a number, but it's per unit of what? Well, we think serum water, but it isn't, it's serum. The machine can't tell the difference. This woman had the most gross hyperlipidemia I've ever seen. When I'd corrected the sodium for the lipid in the blood, she was actually in need of water, not sodium. It saved her life. But that sort of thing is illegal. Now, you couldn't shout across the corridor, could you? But anyway, this was a conversation with an orthopedic surgeon. I love pediatric orthopedic surgeons. They're amongst the nicest people in medicine. I don't know why, but they are. Bill, and he was interested in what I've been doing in Jamaica, and you know me well enough to know that conversations would go in all directions. And my trivial pursuit mind said, "You know, I know you do a lot of CP. We occasionally saw a malnourished child who we thought had cerebral palsy as well, but when we'd refed them, they didn't. In fact, we did a study, and we were astonished to discover that a malnourished child can eat all its muscle, right down to empty myotubes. So that when you do a muscle biopsy, there are no muscle fibers there. 6 weeks after starting treatment, the myotubes are full of glycogen. 6 weeks after that, they're normal myotubes again. That's how far, I don't know to what age that happens, but it happens in these children. He said, "I've got a patient for you to see." And off I went to see one of his difficult patients. They couldn't get out of hospital because of recurrent fevers. ID would give antibiotics for an organism they couldn't find. She'd get better for a week or two. It had happened again. But when I looked at her, she was malnourished. I'd never seen, thought about this. I mean, I remembered you always used to accept that CP children wore socks in summer, right? Because they were always cold. I'd never thought about why until that moment. And I went back to Bill and said, "She's malnourished. Do we need to go through any special committee?" He said, "No, I think you can try." So I treated her like a malnourished child. She got better. She didn't. Her fevers went away. She was discharged. She didn't come back for several months. After that, the orthopedic surgeons wouldn't operate on quadriplegics until I'd seen them first. And usually, I just have to watch the operation date, and we would bring them in early enough. I could actually calculate how many days it would take to get them to the required rate, because you can actually say exactly how fast they're going to grow. When if there's no disease going on, they're going to grow. While they're making lean tissue, every 5 calories will give you a gram. If they're making fat, you need 9 calories to make a gram. So you can actually plot it out and know when they're going to be at optimal weight for surgery. I went to the computer. We didn't have personal computers in those days, so I went to the laboratory. I went to the library, rather, and did a search. And everything that I could put in, any combination of cerebral palsy and nutrition, brought absolutely nothing. Wanting to do it ethically had opened up a totally virgin field in terms of research. There was nothing in the literature. So we ended up writing it and putting the first permanent feeding tubes into CF kids. Nobody had ever measured the efficiency of feeding. And by the grace of God, I was reviewing a grant for the Canadian equivalent of NIH, and it was from an occupational therapist. It was very worthy but rather boring research, but she was trying to quantify swallowing. I made sure she got her grant, and then I called her and said, this is off the record, you're going to get your grant, but you owe me. Please come and look at a problem. She was delighted, of course, to have a problem like this. And the first paper we wrote together was on the fact that CP children who have quadriplegia have a feeding efficiency of about 10% of normal. That means, since you eat for an hour a day to maintain your body weight, those children are going to be malnourished, not because of neglect, but because no system can afford that much feeding by hand. So we bypass the problem. And they immediately warm up, they start smiling. It's fantastic. One set of parents wouldn't let me put a tube in, because they were from Quebec, and they'd got, both had got pensions from the government of Quebec to look after this child. And they loved the child. The child was their life. And they spent 8 hours a day feeding. 8 hours in every 24. And they knew when they couldn't keep up with it, because he stopped smiling. Then they would come in and see me. They'd only allow me to put a tube down until he started smiling again. Then they took him home. But his smile was like, it's another illustration of what these children are like. The nurses, you could watch them, they constantly, when they went round the ward, they would go past Denis' bed just to see him smile at them. He changed the atmosphere of the ward. Now, this is what we're talking about today, is the how are we going to deal with technology that is concerned only with efficiency and doesn't have a moral column in the account book? It's difficult. I don't know how we're going to do it. CRISPR is going to accelerate it. The problem of technology is a real one. What's the difference between science and technology?
Science is knowledge and technology is instruments.
Yes. That technology is about application, largely. So you can tell a technologist what to do if you know that in principle it's possible. You can't tell a scientist what to do, because you have to get out of bed every morning. And that's a very strange phenomenon. I got out of bed every morning for 25 years for one protein. I wouldn't get out of bed for the protein being studied in the next lab, and I can't tell you why. From the moment I met the phenomenon as a medical student, I was fascinated by it. How on earth is that done? Nobody knew at that point. Nobody knew how we made a membrane potential when I went to medical school. Well, that's not quite true. There were some physiologists already knew, but the world at large didn't know. It didn't take long, and we didn't know the mechanism. Really, that happened a little later. Jan Skou from Denmark got the enzyme. When he came to America to do his been to America bit of your career in Europe, he didn't like the lab, so he sat on the beach in California for a year and thought about what he had to do. And when he went back, he'd got one of the most important enzymes in the body. In fact, you're spending 45% of your energy on it at this moment. It's the major energy transduction system in the body. So technology, you can tell what to do. But science, you have to be motivated. And it's fascinating. The whole idea of tacit knowledge. Is there anybody here who doesn't know the phrase tacit knowledge? Please be honest if you don't. Well, that's several of you, so I'm going to impose on the rest of you, because I think it's an incredibly valuable concept. The place to read about it is Leslie Newbegin's book, Foolishness to the Greeks. But the reason it's of interest is it's not technical, it applies to the faith as well. Where does tacit knowledge occur in your faith? You're forbidden, Aaron, because I know you know the answer. Anyone else? So you all don't know where tacit knowledge fits in your faith. Well, it fits in conversion. because you can't explain your conversion, not in the reductive sense that a scientist would want. You know that it happened. That's one of the most incontrovertible facts in your life. But you can't explain to anyone else how it happened. Even Lewis couldn't. Lewis being the man he was, he could describe his move from atheism to theism. That was rational. Picked up and carried, kicking and struggling into the kingdom. But that only made him a theist. And made him say his prayers, and of course he discovered sin. But the next thing that happened was getting on the bus to go from Magdalen College to just up the hill to, I've forgotten the name of the area, Oxford now, where he lived. It was a 5-minute journey, and he said he was offered something. It was a free choice, and all he can do is manage some mixed similes. He says, it was a free choice. It was like taking off a suit of armor or stiff clothes. It was like being a snowman pushed out into the sun and beginning to melt. It was unpleasant. But I said yes. Only in retrospect, as he say, he realized he was saying yes to God. But he didn't know what to do with Jesus. And that's even worse. And he says, he didn't know what to do with Jesus. And there's some doubt as to exactly where this happened, but it was related to this experience. He went with his brother to Whipsnade Zoo, some 40 miles away, a sort of natural environment zoo, and he watched the wallabies jumping around in the bluebells for an hour or two, came back to Oxford, and he believed that Jesus was the Son of God. And he doesn't tell you any more than that, because that's all he knows. Then he spends the rest of his life telling the rest of us how to work out what it means to be a disciple. Really, that's what he did. Amazing contribution. Tacit knowledge is the knowledge you have that is real that you can't explain in the modern sense of explanation. The best easy to grasp example is the guy who gave the idea to the Western world, Mankel Polanyi, a Hungarian Jew who ended up in Manchester in the 1930s. And was fascinated particularly by what working class men made in the shed at the bottom of their garden. Because in those days, computerization, automation was only just beginning. Working class men, the best of them were toolmakers. They made amazing things. And Polanyi was fascinated by this phenomenon of creation that couldn't be described by science. And one of his favorites was a man who made violins, because he liked making violins, and he knew when he'd made a good one. But he wasn't a violinist. Who decided they were really good? The Halle Orchestra, one of the world's best orchestras. They discovered this man, and then lots of people in the Halle Orchestra were using his superb violins. And the way tacit knowledge works there is, of course, he knows when he's made a good violin, but he can't tell you why. If you want to be a violin maker, you have to find someone like that, and he'll look at your work, and in most cases, he'll say, don't bother, you haven't got what it takes. Don't waste your time. But every now and again, he might say, well, perhaps come and watch, sweep the floor, make the coffee, and gradually you're allowed to do more and more. And eventually, a great day comes when he gives you a valuable piece of alpine pine and says, cut out the top or the bottom for this violin. And he knows violin, they measured it, that's the first point. And so you've cut it and you give it to him and he feels it and he says, you can take a bit more off there. Or he will say, oh dear, you've taken a bit too much off there. This will not be a great violin. He knows, but he can't tell you how he knows. We know he knows because people buy his violins who can really play. That's tacit knowledge. And it's something we should major in. What we know that we can't explain doesn't mean it isn't knowledge. You know that in medicine, don't you? If you go into an OR and somebody from your specialty is at work, how long does it take you to know how good he is? I've forgotten your name already.
Paul.
I know you're an orthopedic surgeon. How long does it take?
5 minutes.
And that would be a long while.
Well, I want to make sure.
But you don't know how you make that decision. You can rationalize it afterwards. You think of what you do and you rationalize it in that way. But you know first. You recognize your spouse, but it's not the way that you would tell anyone else to recognize your spouse because you don't need any of those things. You just know. and it's real. So the reason we need to talk about this a lot more is because if we're going to confront the world we're facing, we need mechanisms that will actually stop them in their tracks, the people who are not, they're not, they don't have bad intent. They're just not thinking it through. I every now and again will meet someone on the lecture circuit in a liberal environment who knew me in my days as a trendy scientist. And obviously when you're speaking in university these days, your mugshot always appears. Even if you don't have one yourself, that they'll find one somewhere. And I'm still recognizable. Facially, the hair colour has obviously changed, but people don't have any problem. And so they'll turn up at the lecture, just, you know, for old time's sake. And then if they're British, they'll be rude, and the conversation will go something like this. Haven't seen you for a while, no. I don't go to the meetings where we used to meet anymore. He said, oh, yeah, I used to read your stuff till the mid-90s. The clear implication being that I lost my mind in the mid-90s. And I say, you think I lost it? And he said, well, you write rubbish now, don't you? And I said, well, I think I can prove you're wrong. What do you call somebody who's lost their mind? And you have to say mad or crazy, right? What happens to their life? Well, it falls apart. Well, even my wife, who's not my greatest supporter at times, would agree that when I started taking faith seriously, life got better, not worse. She says, I now should be much further on than I am. That's what she always says. That's why I don't normally look at her. So that's the reality. And then you can say to them, your problem is that you've bought a reductionistic view of the world, which is a good way to do science. There's no room in a scientistic, reductionistic model for my faith, but there's plenty of room in my faith for reductionistic science. So which is the bigger box? That's a no-brainer. And if you knew some history, I say, and you went back to the 17th century and took the top 100 names of scientists from the 17th century, the golden age of science, you would find that only two of them were skeptics, and all the rest believed, and half of them very seriously, devoutly. What do these names have in common? Newton, Boyle, Faraday, Clerk Maxwell, Eddington, just to take one sequence, you know the answer. They're Christians, and they are Protestant Christians, and three of them are evangelical Protestant Christians. It sort of doesn't fit with their preconceived notions. And it's these preconceived notions which are dominating what we're willing to do now. CRISPR, which you gave me as the title, is just an acronym for something originally discovered in viruses. Basically, it's the search and replace function that you have on the word processor. That's viruses use it, so cells use it so that when a virus comes, they can snip out a bit of whatever the virus is, RNA or DNA, and then they've prepared for the next time it comes along that they can deal with the virus. So you can use this, they put it together with an enzyme that cuts up DNA. So you can use this search, destroy and replace mechanism in human cells. So you can incubate the cell that you want to change and end up with a new piece of DNA that's the normal one for the bit that you've taken out. This is elegant in the extreme. I had to go and look at what they were doing. I could hardly believe that this was possible, but it is. And obviously some diseases are going to be got at very effectively. Certainly things like sickle cell anemia and the hemoglobinopathies are a sitting target now. It's just who's going to get there first in terms of the details that make it worse. Because you can take a cell out of the body and correct it and put it back, and sometimes you don't even need to do any more than that. It will override the one that is damaged, and if not, you can kill the bone marrow briefly and put in the new marrow that is theirs. It's antigenically okay. Cystic fibrosis is another one. This tiny little gate, literally a gate on a chloride channel, is a single gene, a very small piece, and that ought to be possible to do as well, and I think it will be. So it's very exciting. But now we've got the problem of how do we decide what we will change and what we will not change? Is anything sacred in the modern world? I came across it long ago. But I had this list of comparisons, and I didn't write down where I got it. I'm sure it's not mine. It's comparing what it was for us and what it is now. And you can decide which specialty it is they're talking about. Truth has become either truth in inverted commas or mere perspective. Freedom for us is freedom for them it's freedom from. Moral foundations for us are moral neutrality for them. Duty becomes choice. Obedience becomes autonomy. Law and justice as discovery become law as man's creation. The imago Dei becomes the evolved man. Rights and reciprocal responsibilities are turned into rights defined by political groups. Conscience as sacrosanct becomes client-determined duties. And tolerance as a result of sin versus tolerance as a primary good. That's a pretty stunning set of changes that have occurred in our society basically since the so-called Enlightenment. That's the Enlightenment result, if you like. And I don't think it's actually overstated. The first thing I wrote, which brought me to the attention of David Stevens, was called The Myth of Moral Neutrality. And I wrote it in about 3 hours flat. Our Department of Education, Faculty of Education, sent a missive around the university saying that teaching in a modern state-funded university should be from a morally neutral position. I was so angry, steam was rising, because of course there is no such position. It would do well in Alice in Wonderland, but nowhere else, only in a place where words mean what I choose them to mean. So it flowed, references, quotations, everything, and at the end of the afternoon, I felt better, and I sent it to a friend to read, and instead of reading it, he published it, without my permission. It was only a little Christian journal for 1,500 people, so I didn't bother about it, because I knew the stuff I'd published in the mainline scientific literature is read on the whole by 6 people. It's not about knowledge, it's about careers. They don't read your CV, they weigh it. When you are quoted, you're twice as likely to be misquoted as correctly quoted. And so it goes on. That's the modern world. You call me cynical, but I'm also being blatantly and brutally honest at that point. A few weeks later, or maybe months later, I don't know, David Stevens found this thing. And he called me in my office, and he said he'd recently come from Africa to take over what was then CMDS US. And he was a very smart man who understood that CMDA, which was a fellowship organization, was going to need to be much more than a fellowship organization if it was going to play the role that it could. But he had no idea how to go about it. And he called me and said, I've just listened to a tape of yours several times. And I said, I don't think so. I don't make tapes. He said, it's your voice. I couldn't argue with that. I asked the title, and it was The Myth of Moral Neutrality. And to this day, I don't know where it was recorded. He said it was an amateur recording, so it's probably a small group, and somebody had got a tape recorder, and they just switched it on. But such are the ways of God, it got to David Stevens. The result was I came down to the US and recorded a few talks and went back to Ottawa, and a year later I was giving 100 talks a year across the continent. And I ended up talking to the Cuban Minister of Health and people like that, going to the Ukraine to tell them why they couldn't run a health system, all because of that paper published in an obscure little journal. But it's where we are now. Moral neutrality is what the world thinks is the way you should behave, despite the fact that it doesn't exist. It's a figment of the imagination. Humpty Dumpty thought it up. But that's where we're at. So in this world, what do we do? where do we go from here? Eugenics is back. What comes next? Well, we know historically which nation in the Western world was most upset by eugenics?
Germany.
They didn't start with the Jews. They started with eugenics in the disabled. Before the Jews, there were the disabled, there were the gypsies and the homosexuals. And they made syrupy movies about it. The Jews came much later. And initially, when they got round to the Jews, they didn't know what was happening. It was almost the first act of the Nazi government to make euthanasia legal in order to get rid of useless mouths and to improve the Aryan race. That was the reason. And when they came to the final solution for the Jews, they initially shot naked Jews into trenches they'd forced them to believe. And the Wehrmacht had to do it. And what do you think that did to the soldiers? They started taking to drugs and alcohol, and that wouldn't do. So Hitler stopped it. The Wehrmacht could not be so damaged. And then he heard, who do you think invented the first gas chamber? What was their profession? It's a doctor, a psychiatrist. Yeah. You should all have a copy of the Nazi doctors on your bookshelf. R.J. Lifton, an American left-wing psychiatrist who went to Germany after the Second World War because he wanted to understand what they were doing. And the book is incredible reading, but I think required reading for people today who are inclined to say, well, if somebody wants to be killed, it's your job to do it. You need to think long and hard. When you make a change in conscience, it's a package deal. You don't stop with the bit you want. You stop with everything that is entailed, and that takes time. And the Nazi doctor lays that out for you. Jay Lifton, Lifton. So now they're back. Yes?
So you describe CRISPR as a very beneficial tool in possibly eradicating cystic fibrosis.
Yeah.
What is the other side of it? Why is it so controversial? Because I've heard that it could be misused like the Nazi doctors, but what are they talking about?
Well, it's not controversial. That's the point. If you're a liberal, of course it's not controversial. And for us, we do pray every day, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. But this didn't happen because of sin, did it? God allowed this to happen. And they have a role in this world. When you start killing them, you're saying to those that are still alive, you have no role.
No, I don't mean euthanasia. I just meant you were describing CRISPR as a way of...
Oh, because... thank you. I did truncate that because of being terrified of my wife. No, that's not true. But there was a Chinese guy trying to do it in germ cells. If you do it in somatic cells, there's no long-term implications. But if you start doing it in germ cells, who knows where that one ends? Fortunately, he wasn't a good enough scientist to achieve what he was trying to do. But for a moment, he was trying to put into twins, a different structure, because you know there's a small group of people who don't get HIV. And it's a rare mutation amongst Africans, but it explains why there's whole areas of Africa where they don't get it. They get other problems later on related to that gene, because it's connected to the T-cell receptor in some way. And the virus can't get into the cell without that receptor. So he was think he could make a lot of money if he could do it, because he could tell people in a place where there is an HIV problem, if you let me adjust your children before birth, they can't get HIV. That's what he wanted to do. Now, these things they come as package deals. And he was playing with germline cells. And that is a no-no.
Did he make
many liberals. What?
Did he make a baby?
Did he what? He tried, but he didn't succeed, fortunately. He wasn't a good enough scientist.
He wasn't viable.
No. But he thought he was for a while. You can pick it up in the New England Journal in the last few months if you're interested in the story.
How did he know it wasn't viable?
Well, by testing the children and seeing that he hadn't achieved what he wanted to. The twins were born.
Oh,
But they didn't have his mutation there. Not a mutation, his adjustment. So he didn't get away with it. But do you think there are people who are going to try to do that?
I was just going to say that there's a question about body modification.
Of course. How many men would like to know that their son is going to be, shall we say, 6'8"? How many men would be tempted by that one?
Oh, I would.
Not you, your son. Yeah, but you can go along the list. Women too could. They have their genetic variations that they would. We'd all be tempted, wouldn't we? Or could be. Now, we can presume that God would not allow that to go the way that we want it. He always has the last word. I mean, when Hitler found his ultimate Aryans, as he thought, 6 foot plus with blue eyes, they happened to be mainly stupid, with an IQ that was just about functional, so he gave up that particular pursuit. The cross linkages, you see there, the problem, one of the problems with CRISPR is that yes, you can send it to search and destroy that sequence or replace it, but you only see what you're looking for. Remember that DNA is overwritten. It contains more than one message in that sequence. So you're taking a chip out of another sequence that you don't know about and replacing it with something else. So you've almost certainly going to produce other things. Now, the editing mechanisms of the gene, as we know already, are pretty amazing. We don't know how good they are. You can't know what you do not know. If you've got an imagination, you think what God might be able to do. Are you asking a question or just stretching?
I'm just stretching.
Okay. That's okay. So I presume there will be problems. How long it will take for them to pop up, I don't know. You know that, it's like drugs, isn't it? A new drug comes along and it's wonderful, and then somebody gets aplastic anemia and it's the worst, and then sometime later, used in the right place for the right indications in the right dosages, etc., it's a useful drug. That process goes on again and again with these things. So, those are the things we're needing to be thinking about and talking to people about. What is this going to mean? Yes? I'm not exactly up to date on what is required, but clearly the intention is going to be to get rid of certain diseases. And you are offered those tests. At the moment, I don't think there's any consequence, but that you will be offered them here as well. And I suspect that what they will say is, you can have this baby if you want, but you are on the hook for any medical costs. That's how it will be used. The threat of that has already been explicit in Canada. I don't think it's yet been implied that way, but that is the way it will go. So, I've said enough about this. I want to finish. I meant to bring my quotation book with me, the new one, but I don't have it with me. I left it behind in the room. But in Wendell Berry's book, Life is a Miracle, any of you read it? Just Aaron again. He raises his hand like this. He doesn't wish to draw attention to himself. It's the best essay, pro-life essay I know. The opening chapter, which is, I'm going to paraphrase a bit from it, is actually a discussion of a subtext in King Lear, the story of Gloucester, who was blinded by Lear. And his son was exiled. And the blinded Gloucester is looking to commit suicide. And his son comes to him, disguised as a beggar, fools him into jumping just 2 feet, and then pretends he's jumped a cliff and miraculously survives, and says, "Thy life is a miracle, take it again." Hence the title of the book, "Thy Life is a Miracle." And in that first chapter, he has a wonderful purple passage, which I can't quote accurately, but he points out that there are people who wish to tell us what our life is about, and we must resist them. We don't want other people. almost guaranteed to be inept bureaucrats to have the control, to have control over our lives. When they pushed Christians out of the practice of medicine in Ontario, it will be a very different practice of medicine. The cynics who have no problem with sending people into school to recruit for transsexual surgery, do you think they're going to care about patients in any real degree? I mean, it's just child abuse, and they do it in a children's hospital. Wendell Berry saw this coming. Read the book. The first chapter is beautiful prose. That's not actually Berry who wrote that. He's quoting another poet, a woman. We don't live, I don't think, or I don't live with enough sense of getting up in the morning. I should, given how old I am and how fit we are. The grace of life. And to give thanks for it on a daily basis. Life is a miracle. Use it well. What's coming and what you're going to have to deal with in this area is not going to be easy. But we've been there before. We know that in the end, God's will be done. What that will involve, we don't know. God does not love nations. They come and go. But he loves people. Whatever happens to the Western world in terms of nations, the people who live there are loved by God. Yes, so you had a question? Someone raised their hand. Yeah, so.
Yes, I want to make sure I understood your comment about Ontario. You're saying that because of some of these now sort of avant-garde ideas that have become standard, things with which Christians cannot agree to participate in, so that will force Christians out of the practice of medicine.
It's already happened in Ontario. In the last month, if you will not make an effective referral for euthanasia, you must get out of your job. Or you'll be fired. You're told to go and do something else that doesn't require that. But, I mean, are you going to retrain for another specialty?
Well, so that was your quip about dermatology yesterday.
Okay, it wasn't an attack on dermatology. It's a safe place to be. I don't think they're going to be asked. I'm so ugly, you must kill me, I suppose it's possible.
What would you recommend the Christian doctor do in that case? I mean, is it...
Well, in Canada, we already have one of our friends, his son, talked to me, and he's going to Alberta to do it. He wanted to come home to Ontario as a doctor, now he's going to Alberta, which will be one of the last places to yield.
Why is that?
Just because of different culture. It's all about culture, this. Yeah.
More
American. I mean, Alberta is the most American province of Canada because you brought American habits there. You used to have to buy land in Montana and Canada would give it to you. So the guys who went to Montana sold their land at a profit and moved to Canada. So there's a lot of cross-border traffic between Montana and Alberta. And that's where liberalism's creeping into the West. Yeah. I don't know how that fits together.
So, but to use this monastic example that you discussed yesterday, that in the middle of this cultural chaos, Benedict and the others created a new culture, preserved the old culture. Is there a way that physicians can band together and, sub rosa maybe, just create a new...
Well, they could, but we're notoriously bad at cooperating with one another politically. It could be done, but we're notoriously bad at cooperating politically. I started talking about this problem under four headings over 20 years ago in a talk which some of you have heard called What Hippocrates Knew and We've Forgotten. And it makes the point that Hippocrates understood you need your doctor to fear judgment after death. You need him to recognize that he's in a moral business. You need him to recognize the sanctity of life, and because of that, he will give you rights of conscience. All four of those are under attack. Now, if we could get organized, we would only have to agree when the first people, like the people in Ontario, who may decide that they're going to force the government to fire them, we should all go on strike, rotating strikes every Friday for the whole of the summer. Most of us would like an extra day off at the weekend, so it wouldn't be too painful, but it would be very painful just emergency care on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. What would happen to the queues in Canada? They'd be going around the block. That would get the government's attention. And we could force them, yes, but we're not. We're just not politically astute. We'd only need about 10% of the medical community to join us in this, and that would be a big enough disaster to be a political disaster, wouldn't it? I mean, if that happened in America just before Trump went up, the Democrats forced that in other places, whichever one forced it would lose the election. And they know it. But they're hoping to pick us off bit by bit. And we'll let them do it. My son-in-law won't get engaged, and he's in the firing line. He's an oncologist. He said, I'm just going to resign and leave. Sadly. Well, having ruined your supper, go ahead.